Architects aren't usually professors in the terms of the scholarship that Dr. Cooperman presented. And my talks never seem to take the same sort of pattern. It can't be documented. I wish they could be. I always enjoy that. I found the information very interesting. So what I'll try to do, though, is speak from the point of view of the physical environment, how one can read it. And I'll try and start from the flyer itself. The initial statement related to our particular subject was an individual's needs and community planning, the personal environment. The first statement, individual needs and community, I can pick up on where Dr. Cooperman left off. There are various kinds of communities, and therefore it makes it very broad when someone asks an architect to plan for one or to make suggestions of how you would plan for one. For example, there's a stationary community, which, as he suggested, has a complete life spectrum. Historical communities, the ones that we sort of look back on nostalgia, are very desirable, and rural communities. And then there's a community of parts and separation, which is the suggested as a suburban one, where you live in one place and work in another, and you have divided interests as sort of a segmented thing. And then there's the projected one that people like to deal with is the world community, which is based upon an information and a transportation system. So the question is, well, how do you plan for something like that? There's a great many points of views. How do you bring qualities to these particular environments? How would you equate choices related to these particular environments? And the other question, I suppose, is what all these environments have in common. If you were to take the 15th century concept of the piazza and compare it with the 20th century concept of the parking lot in front of the drive-up service center, what do they have in common? How do you decide about a particular environment? Well, that's the first statement, and that's the one I tend to pick up on in the workshop Saturday. I'll deal with the smaller one today, the personal environment. I think that the personal environment is sort of a premise to begin with, and I think the issues that I'd like to talk about there is, what is an environment? Why does an environment look as it does? How does it affect human behavior? And how does one change or have a possibility of affecting change in that particular setting? What is environment? Well, that's a well-used term. It's a natural one. There's a mechanical one, a structural one, a technological one, a humane one. There's a preconceived one. There's a conceived one. Which are sort of interesting because they do begin to suggest that people bring to an environment a particular set of attitudes. And that's what I suggest is the beginnings of understanding environment. But let's bring it closer. It says personal environment. Well, let's start there. Let's start with costumes. I think that's a rather interesting environment. Suppose that you're going to a bank to ask for a loan. How do you dress? Now suppose you're going out into the countryside to get a deal on some old furniture. How do you dress? Sit down. Now that's not good nor bad, it just exists, you see. And that's a costume, it's being applied to a particular situation. Suppose we had a nude man standing here. That'd be a few things you could tell about him. Now suppose, however, though, that particular person had on a black pair of pants, a black shirt, a blue tie, a black belt, a badge, helmet, and a gun. You see, you begin to have a perception about that particular man. Now suppose that same man is standing here and he's wearing a dress. Okay, you have a completely different image, same person, however. Suppose, though, that that dress is black, it goes to the floor, it has full sleeves, and has a white collar. All of a sudden, the perception changes again. See, in other words, you take with you a particular set of analogies already, which begin to shape an environment, and there are symbols that are set up which reinforce that. And in this particular manner, then, you can begin to read some characteristics of society. Okay, let's move out of the costume or the near environment and go to one contemporary one. I would suggest that all these particular places, an environment, a community, a machine, a computer, have absolutely no initial characteristics. or personalities, in other words. People tend to bring those to that and gives it form. So let's shape something. Let's take waiting rooms, for example. I think that's a rather interesting environment. Picture in your mind an attorney's waiting room. Now, these are stereotypes, but we have to use those things, I guess. Strong, dignified, authoritarian. In other words, you would never go in there to ask for money. In fact, the better the environment is at communicating that, the more you will spend. Okay. Then think about a doctor's waiting room. Usually white, clean, clinical. You wouldn't catch anything there, you see. Unless you want to change your image, then they're slightly residential, you see. Now think of the welfare's waiting room. See. Now they have all exactly the same function, but they have incredibly different appearances. Why? Okay. It's getting the why things look as they do. Let's take a very contemporary example. Let's take McDonald's as a particular environment. How many remember Henry's? Okay. See, Henry's were there first with a squat and gobbles concept. But see, they're no longer in existence. You may not even see them anymore except as realty offices or used car lots or those kinds of things. But why aren't they in business anymore? In other words, they had, you know, the 15-cent hamburger in 10, 15 minutes and then out. But McDonald's exists. Well, have you ever been to McDonald's when it's raining? You ever notice a person mopping the floor? They'll do it right behind you. In other words, you'll go in and that person will mop right behind you. I wouldn't do that. You'd kind of wait till it got done raining, you see, and mop the floor. And then you look behind the counter and everybody runs. It's incredible. I mean, even if there's a few people out front, they're running and they bounce off each other. That sort of thing. They could probably do it better, you see, if they would move slowly, but they see they don't. But the interesting fact is, if you would take that person who runs in McDonald's and put him in Henry's, he wouldn't do that any longer. Or you take that person who mops the floor when it rains and you put him in Henry's and they wouldn't mop the floor anymore. Why? Because some particular person says, when you work in my place, you will run and you will mop the floor, and they do it. And they do it all the way across the country. That person's not even there. And that shapes an incredible environment. See? So that's an incredible kind of power that brings a particular character. You never go to McDonald's, spend $35, and spend 4 hours. You know, it's $3, 50 minutes, whoosh, out. That's the design. They affect the environment that way. They've designed it, and we behave appropriately. Not good nor bad, it just exists. Okay. Let's take another kind of one. City Hall. Okay. Another kind of space in a community. The argumentation that most politicians present when they're in the process of being elected is grassroots. In other words, I'm your elected official. You can come to me. I will present your problem, which is genuine, and that's real. The buildings, however, that they put them in, I suggest, aren't always the same, you see. Think of a building that you can just drop in offhandedly off the street. You know, Red Owl, hardware stores, those kind of things. Not City Hall, usually. The higher the political office is, the more green that's around it, you see. And then there's up this flight of steps, and you walk down this corridor, and you hear your heels clicking all the way. And then you meet your first barrier. What are you doing here? You have an appointment, you see? And then in the design process, you see, that we get involved in, the executive always wants two ways out. One that doesn't go through the waiting room, you see? Now, that's not bad, again. It's just a reality. Now, that's something to be checked on. I think that's a responsibility of someone who lives in a particular culture. If the statement is one, and the image and the response is something else, then they're really not in balance. Let me give you an example of Dayton's. You know, if you go to Dayton's, when they're, oh, you know, they got the whole row of doors. Always, all those big rows of doors. When you go there and they're open, all those doors are open. They wouldn't dare risk the idea of, you think, walking up to their department store and have one of the doors closed and think it was closed and go away. Because that's their image. Now go up to a high school, which has the same row of doors. Thump, 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 thump. And then you find the one that's open. Can you imagine a high school with a door like Red Owl? You'd walk up and go, whoosh. You know, you'd step back out and you would look to see if it was, you know. It's humorous, but it's a particular statement. And that's what I'm getting at, is it beginning to look at cultures in that particular manner. And it's interesting because if you take a society and read its buildings, it's nothing new. Because think about what an archaeologist does. What do they dig up? Buildings. Artifacts. And what's their whole job? Is to re-describe what happened, what the culture was. It'll be an interesting phenomena about 10,000 years from now when they dig up ours. By that time, most of the bones will be gone. But what they will find is they'll find a parking lot and a bank and then a parking lot and a laundry and then a parking lot and a movie theater and then a parking lot. You see, and that's that wonderful mechanical creature, you know, it had so many advantages in its lifetime. However, if they would have dug up our culture 100 years before, it wouldn't have been anything like that at all. It's really significantly different. But the question that keeps coming up, is there any constants? Well, there probably are, but they change forms. The constants remain the same, but I think that the shapes change. Let me give you an example of, again, Minneapolis. We have a big public street, the mall, which is a very wonderful gift for any city to have. If you go back again to something like the 15th century, they had piazzas. In other words, pedestrian areas where people would come. Okay, what dominated that? What was the dominant form in that space? The church, of course. That was the particular element that did. Okay, when you look at the mall, what dominates it? Dayton's. Dayton's. Sure. The IDS tower, it's legitimate. We have different building forms. But what, if you have a long space, what's really important about the long space, along what side of it? It's on either end of it. Okay. At one end, interestingly enough, it will terminate on a community activity, the arts, which I think is really interesting. However, the other end, the first terminus, you see, terminates on what? Insurance building. Very interesting. In other times, it would have been some particular function. What I think is significant, though, the architect who did it played this incredible satirical thing. I don't know if he was that brilliant about it or not, or he did it consciously or not, but he made it look like a temple. See? You're not sure if you're supposed to fall down and worship or go in and buy insurance. You see? But anyway, it's a particular statement. And as you move around, you can begin to see some of these kinds of things, and I think they're rather interesting because they do describe to you quite a bit about a community, just as close as your near environments do. And there's nothing really difficult about it. In fact, up to about 100 years ago, everybody did their own environment. They defined it, and they're rather very interesting. In other words, you leave people alone with beer cans or rice fields or whatever for many, many decades. Eventually, they'd produce an environment so beautiful it would make you weep. But today, our cultures are too complex, so we turn it over to experts. But the question is, you know, how are we operating within that particular kind of information? And that's where I suggest that architects are physical historians of an age. They're predestined to do that. You know, to record in stone the hopes and desires and the wishes of a society. And the reason that they're so good at it, you see, or we're so good at it, is we don't know we're doing it. So we're unconscious to the fact. Historians know they're historians, you see, and it changes. The idea of measuring something changes a particular thing about it. Okay, let's go on the other part then. Does environment affect behavior? I would suggest if it does, it also reflects it. Winston Churchill said, we build our buildings, we shape our buildings, and our buildings in turn shape us. That's a rather interesting statement. I would suggest though that it's not as harsh as that. I think that the environment affects behavior more like seasons. In other words, if we painted this room all red, you would have to go to the bathroom in 5 minutes. I don't believe that that kind of thing really works. But I do believe softer kinds of things do. People do respond in subtle ways. In other ways, when you wake up in the morning, it's rainy and gloomy. Maybe for you, that doesn't feel so bad of going to work because you know you're not missing anything, you see. Or if it's sunshiny or fall or winter or whatever, you begin to have response to that. Buildings softly do the same thing. And people do begin to respond to that sort of thing. Now, why is that so important? Well, I think that David's example of the expanding metropolis is very interesting. Most of the lives that people live, probably even more than 90% of your own life, is always in a man-made, man-conceived environment. Even when you go to a natural one, like a national park, the concept is you find a beautiful place, you build a road to it, you see, and you put up gates, and then you sell tickets, and then you move along pathways, you see. Again, not good nor bad, but it's becoming very dominant. And I think that we should begin to be aware, one, on a probably a professional level, but on certainly the people who use the system. Because environments can happen three ways. One, by design, total design, new towns are those kinds of examples. One's by evolution, the historical ones we look back, a long period of time, and not a real force of professionals doing things, but sort of an evolution of people doing their own environments, or by default. And by default is merely, and somebody else does it, and the input is very low. Okay. What I would like to do then, because the first part of this presentation today deals with, you know, just what an environment is and its relationship to behavior and how you move around it every day and probably really don't see it. I would like to suggest that buildings are really sort of miniature communities. In other words, corridors to rooms and various kinds of functions. You have some sort of movement system that takes you to these places. Some places are served, and some places are servant spaces. Some places are grand, some places are small, but they all work together. The great architect Liu Kahn said that buildings are really a society of rooms. And so what I'd like to do then is show you a society of rooms in one particular building. We'll take a school. Let's see. It's very near. Everybody's had an association with it. But I would like to sort of guide you through how this particular environment is shaped and how it does affect behavior. And then at the end, maybe tie it together in terms of a larger community. Okay, move the lights, please. Okay, there. That's a school anywhere. This happens to be North St. Paul. We're not picking on them. Just happens to be one of the projects in our office. Students don't go by here every day and say, boy, that's really a crummy environment. I don't want to go there anymore and all that sort of business. But like I said, it is a season. It is in the background. It does affect behavior. I'll give you an example of an unsophisticated person sort of responding to this. I have a little boy, and up to the time that he was about 7, I used to ask him to identify buildings. It was really an interesting game. And he could get churches right, and he could get grocery stores and filling stations and homes and all those kinds of things. But the thing that he had the most problem with were schools and factories. Okay. Let's take a look at attitude in shaping. I keep using the word attitude because in reality I believe that's the single most influence in forming an environment. Because see, materials have no characteristics. Dollars really have no characteristics. But the force that shapes them are the people behind it that use it. And that begins to give particular form. Take this for example. Can you imagine driving up there with your child or student and being met by the headmaster? He pulls out this leather book and says, it'll only cost you $5,000 a semester. Send your student here. You'd throw up. See? You don't believe that, you see. Now, think of a private school environment. Same kind of buildings, really. Differently arranged than that. But usually you approach along a long green path, a roadway, some gates, ivy covered and vines and all that sort of thing, you see. And image is appropriate. Okay. Now this particular one, the attitude is shaped that, by the way. We had to landscape that particular school. But the Board of Education said, no, we can't do that. It's creeping elegance, you see. It's a philosophy, you see. Well, this is a sidelight. The way our office approaches things is a creative problem solving method. If we believe the form is correct, there's always another solution. In that particular case, we did landscape the school. What we did is we wrote a course for horticulture, which would use the school grounds, you see, as the classroom, and then it was always funding for new class materials. It happened. It was actually even better than that, you see. So that's another way, and that is an attitude, again, that still shapes the environment. Now again, look, there's nothing wrong with those materials. They'll last forever, for sure, you see. So let's go to something we can analyze. I always like to do entries, you see, because they're so essential. They're very much like people, you see. They tell you a lot about what you can expect. Suppose that you're on an elevator ride, you see, and the door's open, and there's this really attractive lady, except doing this for the gentleman. There's a really attractive lady standing there, and then she's got her arms folded, and she looks over the top of her glasses. What do? Stand there and watch the numbers go by until you get to your floor and you get off. Now suppose it's that same lady, and she's standing there, and the elevator door opens, and she says, well, hello. Well, you know you're going to ride to at least to her floor, you see. Buildings in a soft way do some of the same kind of things. You know, there's the entry to this building. There's nothing wrong with it. It's code. You have to find which door is open, of course. Nevertheless, it solves all the functions of entry. But here's another kind of entry. It's another kind of school. Look at the contrast. Communities do this. Because communities are a collective expression. Communities or neighborhoods or whatever the definition is a collective expression of a group of people, a group of individuals, a power structure, whatever. The better the balance, of course, the more rounded it is. Okay? See, now here's a leftover space in front of this school. People do not travel from all over the world to see this leftover space. People do, though, travel from all over the world to see this leftover space. It's an attitude. Of course, there's a function going on here that relates, but nevertheless, there's an attitude that shaped this particular thing. Now, here's a leftover space, see? That's really the main entry. Most architects are still not willing to admit the idea that the main entry of school is from the parking lot. See, they have the symbolic entries all along the front. But those aren't used in the games. Everybody comes through the loading docks and in the back door, you see. And that's what I'm suggesting, this 15th century nostalgia thing. What are the same values that are always the same? You see? And if we can identify those, then we won't get caught up maybe in some of these things. And being able, as David said, to live within the time that we do, you see, rather than projecting one into the future. Just within the time. Here's another leftover space in another community. See? What that is the intersection of two streets. The normal situation that happens is the center sort of deteriorates and then they build a shopping center at the edge of town. This particular community said, hey, wait a minute. And they just roofed the intersection where the shops already were, open on both ends and that, so you can still go through. But you see, it was a particular idea. And then a commitment, and then some trust. Somebody said, hey, wait a minute, I don't think that's a good idea. And well, I don't know about those people. And then finally, this particular follow-through, and it happened. Okay. Here's another kind of city. People, like, think about this. They get in a plane, they pay a ticket, and they fly all the way to be in this space. That's basically what it is. Because when you strip away all the flowers, it's concrete city. And it has the same function as any city you happen to live in. They just speak a different language, but I don't think people pay the money to go to hear a different language. You see, it's got shops and businesses and all these sort of things. There's something intrinsic about the environment that people go. This happens to be Stockholm. Happens to be the same latitude that we're on. But some particular person, just like McDonald said, we'll plant flowers in the city. Now, flowers aren't the solution only, but it is a symbol. Now, here, let's go to the, remember we talked about streets. Okay. That's the entry to this particular school. Most schools are about 300 yards of toilet, you see. Because, you see, they're easy to keep clean. You see, it evolved like the zoo is about 10 euros. Keep them clean and keep them passive. Now, some brilliant fellow came to the conclusion, said, wait a minute. Maybe zoos should look like the environment the animal came from. Nobody likes to go to a zoo and see the polar bear walk along the edge of the pool, hop on three legs, you know, and then go back. And he does this all day. If you put him in his natural habitat, he'd be ostracized for doing that. So, but nevertheless, here's a design by default. Maybe a school should say, use me, challenge me, and excite me, rather than keep me clean and keep me passive. Now, there are people who sit down in the State Department and figure out, how can we bore these kids for 12 years? See? That's not their job. Their concern happens to be, however, how can we get 300 people out of this end of the building in 30 seconds? And how can we maintain this at a low cost for maintenance so the taxpayers don't pay extra, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, that's one force. But if that's the only value, then there's something dangerous, you see. Because how many kids do you know on Saturday afternoon say, hey, let's go wander the halls of school because they're so interesting. See? But isn't that what it's about, you see? Wasn't that the intent? But how, we let that go, you see. And that's only one characteristic. That's only one place. That's only, remember I said a building. And a building is a society of rooms. And multiplied and magnified, and you get a distortion. You get personality distortion. It happens so easily. You eliminate certain kind of human values from a situation. You get personality distortion. Prison's a perfect example. You send in normal adult male people, and you get homosexuality. Then they hire all kinds of people to study. Why'd that happen? You know? Well, you send these kids to school. You wonder why they write on the wall, why they bust down the toilets, and that, why they run away. You know, why is your school environment bad? How do you know when your school environment is bad when you have only four basic colors to choose from, and all of them are green? You know. You know your basic school environment is bad when the high point of the day is fire drill. You know. Or you know your environment is bad when the 3 minutes between the class has more relevance than the classroom. You see. Some of those kinds of things. That's personality distortion. Okay. 3:15, whew, they're out. You see. Legislated behavior. Maybe just a corridor in a school could be a shopping street of education. And it would look like this. See? Look at the difference. You could sell a canoe out of there. Okay, come here, buddy. Got a deal. You know, that wouldn't work. Because they need the confine. What most teachers don't realize is that students are being sold too, not in a hyped situation, but in a situation where they're legislated to be there, they go into a classroom, and then they have to convince them, they have to sell them, this piece of information is valid. Okay, well, this particular environment understands it. In other words, just like the Red Owl Door, we want you in, we're gonna make this comfortable, make it pleasant, and we're gonna communicate something to you in the time being. Think about aquariums and shopping centers, you know? Little kids pull their parents up, hey, look at this, it's really neat. Even the parents kind of look at it then. And think about the aquarium in a school. See, it's educational. And it's aluminum, you look into it, you see, and you study it. And kind of forget that it's a sort of a total kind of experience. You know, you write poetry here, or here. In other words, there's an appropriateness. You know, it's hard to carry on chemistry here, you see. But you have to allow for those choices. Here's another kind of thing that's really interesting to read, lobbies. You remember the white bank, the insurance bill I told you about? If you want to really do something really risque, is go into their lobby and pull out a white sheet of paper, you know, clean white sheet of paper, and then do something on it. That is non-existent in that building otherwise. Every other piece of paper in that particular building has some particular square, line, and place to write, fill in, and who called, and whatever. No. See? You let these things happen. But anyway, this image of the school. Right, main entry. Everybody comes in. Read it. What does it say? Jock City. You know, the only time, you can see how many people are there. The only time is when they're selling tickets for that kind of event. But isn't school music? Isn't it art? Isn't it foods? Isn't it nutrition? Isn't it health? Isn't it all that whole spectrum of life? That's what school's about, a little microcosm to expand. But people just don't really go there very much. But this place they do. Isn't it music? Isn't it art? Isn't it transportation? Isn't it health? Isn't it food? See, it's a bizarre. Communities tend to do that, though, you know, as David said. Well, if you only let my kind in here, and then we only put this people here, and this people here, you get a real distortion. And then you call it the quality. So what you do is you get in a plane, you go over to Europe to feel that nice stuff. You know, you come back and say, boy, it's really, you know, pick my turf kind of thing. That idea of a negative force coming in to give a collective form is really interesting. We'll come back to that at the end. Now, here's an example of a dominating kind of environment, and to show you how single forces without creativity can affect it. You know why kids don't want to have proms in school? You see? Can you imagine? Come on, I'm going to take you to the lunchroom for a date. Would you spend $30 here to eat? No. But you would here. Now, the argument is, and this is where you have to be on your toes. This is where you have to be a little bit shrewder than the initial force. The argument is that this place looks as it does because, number one, it's easy to maintain and to keep clean, and that's really essential. That's important, you see. You can wipe off those Formica tables and put all that stuff there. A lot, right? Okay. Well, my argument is that this place is even easier to keep clean. All you do is you stack the metal chairs on the metal tables, you take out a hose, wash the tables, the chairs, the floor, and water the plants at the same time. And that's true. That's exactly what they do, you see. So it's the solution, and if the attitude gets distorted... and you don't bring a force to it as an alternative. I mean, you can't just suggest the other one is bad. You must also bring new light to it. I think that represents it. But I think this is the most interesting one, because this is so subtle. This is the wall. Do you realize that there are 15 rules to protect that wall to keep it as beautiful as it is? Do not bend, fold, mutilate, or staple. Do not paint on me, you see? This kind of thing. Well, David was talking about intergalactical kinds of things will clue you in on a new alien being on this particular planet, you see. And they breed, you know they do. There used to be those big vacant fields, you know, and that. Now they're walls all over, you see. And they protect themselves very carefully. Well, see how this happens. I'll give you a little example. Two little boys going to school for the first time. First little boy was told that books are an offering, like walls, they're a service, right? To use it. Sure, somebody wrote it because there was some money in return. That's a fair return for giving out information. But the book itself is information. Use it, take it, add to it, dwell on it, do all this stuff with it. Boy, that was neat. He'd make his own books, you know, write in them, glue in pictures and all this stuff. It was really nifty, you see. Then he goes to school, you see, and he gets his first book. He's really proud. This is his first book, you know. And he draws in it, and he helps out the author by adding more pictures, you see, in it. It's second base. It goes to grandmother's house and all this sort of thing. See, the other boy gets his book, and he takes home, he files it. Okay. Then what happens? They come back at the end of the semester. The old boy brings his book, and he is just tattered. And he slides it up on the desk all beaming. What happens? He's fined. See, the other boy brings his book in, and he gets his money back. Okay. Well, there's two things going on here. One, there's the information conduit. The other one is social values have to be taught. But there's got to be a balance, you see. And that's all of a sudden how something like this takes dominance, you see. Are you familiar with Venice? You know that wonderful city in that? Picture in your mind Venice brought up the code. That's some of the things that we'll work on Saturday. Just another kind of example, jumping out of a school, but just going to a small community, Duluth, is an example of just a subtle attitude change. This is a park in the middle of Duluth. If you're not from there, and even if you've been through there, you may not even know it there, but all the people kind of like to go to there to have lunch. And it's really a nifty little place, you see. And like I said, people gather there. Well, what this is really is a parking lot. And in the middle of the parking lot is this little park, which is usually left over to green grass, which says do not walk on, and they do all these kinds of things to try and maintain it. But in reality, it's a parking lot. But they plant flowers in quantity, you see. They need dominance. Those flowers can't command by themselves, but as a gang, they really can. It's like snowflakes. One or two snowflakes don't make any difference. But a lot of them can stop a 2,000-pound automobile, you see. Well, that's what they're doing. Talk about an ominous gray building. Even coming out of there and paying a $5 ticket, and you're confronted with petunias at your feet, give you a different kind of feeling and response. Strip them away in your mind, and it's something else. Okay.